Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of England, episode 399, Endgame. It is 3 o'clock in the morning at the East Gate in the city walls at Oxford. No time for anyone to be anywhere other than tucked up in bed, you might think, or possibly watching the cricket from Australia. But on the 27th of April, 1646, there is activity at the gate, with two very well-known royal advisers looking to exit the city. At this hour, there were just two of them, with their baggage, which was looked after for them by a servant. They were clearly on important and highly secret business. I mean, why else would they be abroad at this hour? One of them was the divine Michael Hudson, the king's chaplain, fanatically loyal to Charles Stuart. He was also not short of an opinion or two. In fact, Charles had been heard to call him his plain-dealing chaplain. The other was even more illustrious, Jack Ashburnham, a close courtier and adviser to the king, one of those who, with George Digby, had urged Charles to ignore his commander Rupert and attack at Naseby, come what may. Now, anybody wanting to get out of the city at this hour, what with Fairfax forces so close and all, would probably have been laughingly turned away by the city guard. But on this occasion, they got through because the governor of Oxford himself was there to let them out. And so they were through the gate and on their way, clattering over the dreadfully poorly spelled Magdalen Bridge. "Farewell, Harry," came a call from the walls, wishing the servant a good journey as they disappeared into the gloom. Now then, we'll come back to many gated Ilium, or Oxford as it's otherwise known. For now, at the end of episode 398, Fairfax and his new model, if you remember, were heading off to Bristol, critical to the king's cause, one of the few large royal fortresses left, along with Chester, Newark and Oxford. And of course, it was a port, a route for royal salvation from Irish armies, or indeed French or Spanish. Rupert's presence there as governor was a sign of its importance, and Rupert was very, very aware of just how important it was. He had committed to Charles that he would hold it, not quite promising to hold it though its walls were made of butter, but the next best thing, to hold it for 4 months while Charles tried to recover his cause. And Rupert began firing the villages around the walls like Clifton to clear the field of fire for the coming battle. Meanwhile, Charles had woken from the slumber that had followed Naseby. Let's have a quick look around battlefield Britain, shall we, and have a look at the royal options available to him. Here is the gig. In England, it really is not good. He has no major land army. There are bits and bobs here and there. Jacob Ashley is gathering levies in North Wales. Langdale's cavalry from Naseby was at Chester. The shards of Goring's army, Ralph Hopton and Charles, the Prince of Wales, were at Exeter and around there. And the fortress at Newark is still held by its governor, Richard Willis. And there's Oxford, of course. But look, it ain't great. In Ireland, things are really, really complicated. So let's spend a minute or two there, because if Charles is going to get proper fuel to kickstart the coughing and spluttering engine of the royal military cause, it is to Ireland that it was most likely to deliver the expert kick of the mechanic. Quick reprise of the situation. OK, ready for this? After the cessation with the Confederate Association in 1643, Ormond still nominally in control of the Protestant forces in Ireland, and he is in control of the forces around Dublin, though 9,000 troops had been sent home to England to help the king. Although a substantial number of them, who were English Protestants, just deserted to Parliament's side when they got there. And meanwhile, some of Ormond's regional generals wouldn't obey his orders anyway, and in Ulster, the new Scots under Munro certainly weren't having any of that sort of thing. Ormond has been exhorted by Charles to get a permanent treaty signed with the Confederates, but it is slow going. Ormond, you see, was a staunch Protestant, very conscious of getting the best long-term deal for the House of Stuart. OK, on the Confederate Irish side, we have two broad coalitions. There are the traditionalists, who want a deal with Charles based on toleration for Catholics and confirmation of their land rights, and they want to help the king win in England as the basis of that agreement, so they're keen to get another army to him. They had signed the cessation in 1643 enthusiastically. They are now in ascendancy in the convocation. But then there's the clerical party. Now, they are much more militant. They take the Pope's view first and foremost. The Catholic Church must become the established church in Ireland, and they'll have all those church lands back, please. And an agreement with the Stuarts might be a thing, but first task was to win control of all Ireland first. Now, within that political situation, Ormond was doing his best, but Charles's pants were on fire. Charles's management of people is frequently dodgy, I have to tell you. History is littered with them. Hamilton, locked up for doing his best in Scotland with the worst possible hand. Rupert, bad-mouthed and mistrusted. Digby, set at the top table. Goring, forgiven. But here's probably one contender for the Victor Ludorum of the badly treated by the boss prize. The top management balls up. I speak of the Earl of Glamorgan. In June 1643, said Earl landed in Ireland from Charles with a public commission to help Ormond out. And being Catholic and with Irish family connections, he might well indeed be able to help. But while Ormond happily then laboured away to do a long-term peace deal which balanced all the parties and maintained the rights of the king, Glamorgan had actually been given a secret commission by Charles to do his own deal, to conclude a peace with the Irish, whatever it may cost, otherwise known as carte blanche. So, while Glamorgan smiled and waved and nodded sympathetically at Ormond's effort to construct a lasting peace, Glamorgan stitched up a secret deal with the Confederates behind his back to restore land rights, give land to the Catholic Church and offer toleration in return for 10,000 troops sent to England. But no one must know about it until the time was right, so the treaty was to remain secret until those troops reached England. The Confederates started recruiting. So there's that pot cooking, and who cares if Ormond is having his legs sawed off by his boss without him knowing it? The ends surely justify the means when you're dealing with rebels. So another royal pot cooking was in Scotland, where Montrose was flying. On the 15th of August 1645, he faced another army of maybe 8,000 Covenanters this time, with his own 5,000. And yet, he beat them again. The slaughter of Covenanters at Kilsyth was extraordinary, maybe as many as 4,500 of them. Now Montrose entered Glasgow, called a parliament and called for his king to join him. He appeared to be master of Scotland. So, after weighing up his options, it is there that Charles decided to go. This was to be the start of a period of some travel for Charles. In 1645, after Naseby, it's been calculated he travelled 1,200 miles trying to put his cause back on the road. This particular trip was abortive, since he was chased by a parliamentary cavalry force of 3,000 men under one Sydenham Poyntz. So he went with a quack and a waddle and a quack and a very unhappy frown back to Newark, to Huntingdon, Oxford and Worcester. Thwarted in that attempt, his attention now turned to Bristol, and not in a good way. Fairfax arrived in front of the walls with an army of 10,000 men. Inside Bristol, there was a plague, so Rupert had barely 2,000 fit enough to mend the walls. Hugely outnumbered, but still not enough for Fairfax to invest the walls properly and tightly. So the plan from the start from him was to persuade Rupert to save lives and surrender honourably, and if not, to storm the walls. So there was diplomatic to-ing and fro-ing in Rupert's best foot-dragging style, and some dashing sorties equally in Prince Rupert idiom, which gave Rupert all the intelligence to know that he was doomed. Still, the princely foot was dragged in surrender negotiations, so Fairfax ordered the assault at the very unprincely time of 1 o'clock in the morning on the 7th of September. And despite many of the brigades attacking being fought off, Colonel Rainsborough was successful, fighting their way in. So there was more talking, and this time Rupert accepted the inevitable, and to save the lives of the inhabitants from sack, he accepted terms. The terms were honourable. He and his men were allowed to march free, with their swords, but not their guns. This despite the fact that the inhabitants of Bristol disagreed with such leniency and gave cries of, "Give him no quarter! Give him no quarter!" Fairfax and Cromwell disagreed, though. Both met with Rupert, who was clad in scarlet, very richly laid in silver lace and mounted upon a very gallant black Barbary horse. Such is the wrong but romantic idiom. Both Cromwell and Fairfax accompanied Rupert on his first 2 miles towards Oxford. I wonder what they talked about. I'd love to have been a fly on the saddlebags. A couple of bits and pieces after Bristol. One of them is the continuing saga of the growing split between Cromwell and the Independents on one hand and their search for Protestant religious toleration, and the Presbyterian MPs and their search for a new uniformity on the other. So Cromwell's letter home to the Speaker praised his soldiers at Bristol and talked of Presbyterians, Independents, all here had the same spirit of faith and prayer, the same penance and answer. They agree here. No names of difference. Pity it is, should it be otherwise anywhere. So that's nice then. However, when Parliament reprinted this letter, they left that sentence out. Singing the song of religious pluralism was not on the Presbyterian hymn sheet. The bigger story, though, came when Charles got the news about Bristol. So the background is not just Charles's increasingly desperate situation, but also those warm, wet lips pressed to his ears, the lips of George Digby. He had not been slow to poison Charles's trust of Rupert after Naseby, and Rupert had rather helped him out with that with his talks of compromise. But now, with the fall of Bristol, he had a field day. So I am getting the worm tongue and King Theoden thing here to some degree, whispering tales of poison to the ears of the king. In the shattering disappointment of the news, Charles lost any sense of judgment and fired off a letter to his nephew, the sort of letter should really leave 24 hours and reread before sending. In the letter, Charles bemoaned the loss of Bristol. But more than that, "Your surrendering it as you did is the greatest trial that has befallen me. What is to be done after one who is so near to me both in blood and friendship submits himself to so mean an action? I give it the easiest term." Charles then fired his nephew from command, fired his most loyal and his most talented commander. "My conclusion is to desire you to seek your subsistence somewhere beyond the seas." Just to rub salt into the bare, raw wound, Charles insisted that Rupert use a particular passport to quit his realm immediately, and that passport was signed by none other than yours truly, Rupert's greatest enemy, Gorgeous George Digby. At the same time, Charles ordered Edward Nicholas separately to arrest also the governor of Oxford, William Legge, for no better reason than that he was Rupert's ally. Meanwhile, Charles now decided that Montrose in Scotland was his best bet, and he charged off north to Chester to bolster the garrison there, hook up with the remnants of Langdale's northern horse, and then head further north to take control of Scotland with Montrose. Two things resulted on his way. Firstly, news reached him about yet another mighty battle from his new favourite hero, Montrose. Montrose, by the way, had been joined by this time by the fabulously turncoaty John Urry. Really, that man was shameless. And so, Urry was there at Montrose's side at the Battle of Philiphaugh on the 13th of September when Montrose ran into one of Scotland's better commanders, David Leslie, with his battle-hardened troops from the English campaigns. And this time, at last, Montrose's luck and genius deserted him. Philiphaugh was a crushing defeat for him, and the Covenanters were not slow to take vengeance, fired by the lowland suspicion of the Highlanders and the brutality, frankly, of Montrose's campaign so far. When the Highlanders surrendered on promise of quarter, they were gathered up and 50 of them shot, and about 300 other of the soldiers' wives and children were shot too. So that was that. Now, Montrose was indomitable and irrepressible. He fled to the Northern Highlands again, and there he did his level best to carry on a guerrilla-type war. But his big chance, which he had entirely constructed himself with Alistair MacCullagh, had now gone. MacCullagh was not there at Philiphaugh, as it appears. He'd got impatient with all this trying to get King Charles on the throne stuff, and this distraction from the real thing, and he'd return to that real thing, which was, of course, the battle against the Campbells in Kintyre. In the process, burning a building full of Campbell women and children, known thereafter as the Barn of Bones. Ah, the romance of the Highland clans, eh? Eventually, MacCullagh was to run to ground and was defeated in 1647 by the Campbells and would return to the side of his chief, the Earl of Antrim, and have a part to play in the Confederate army in Ireland. There was then more news, which Charles was to enjoy firsthand. And here we can connect with the History of England Tour 2023, for we went to Chester at the History of England Tour, where the walls are magnificent and there is a tower called the Phoenix Tower on them. You can walk all the way around the city. From there, Charles overlooked Rowton Heath, where he saw his brave commander, Marmaduke Langdale, take on Parliament and acquit himself with honour, it must be said. But at the end of it, Charles is supposed to have said, with impressive and even biblical theatricality, "O Lord, what have I done that should cause my people to deal thus with me?" By which you can probably guess the result of Rowton Heath. Chester would continue to hold out bravely, but all Charles could hear now were the sounds of doors shutting. And so he returned by the highways, lowways, and probably more frequently backways, to Newark in the Midlands, where he was approached by gorgeous George Digby, begging a boon. As a result of such begging, Charles fired Colonel Willis, Newark's commander and another friend of Rupert, and then appointed this famous warrior Lieutenant General of all his armies of the North, which was to say, not very much. So Diggers, as the new Lieutenant General of all the armies of the North, had a plan to hook up with Montrose, another wildly optimistic plan. But he took the last of Charles's cavalry with him, headed north, but was intercepted and defeated by Parliament. Happily, he escaped. The loss of such a talent to the royal cause would indeed have been catastrophic, I'm sure you will agree. And he ended up in Ireland. Those Irish are famously lucky. So, there was Charles in Newark in October, having supper, on his uppers, contemplating his reducing options, when there was a commotion outside his doors. And then the doors burst open, and who should it be? Why, crushing forward were his nephew, Prince Rupert of the Rhine, his ex-governor of Bristol, Colonel Gerard, his ex-commander in Wales, and Richard Willis, his ex-commander of Newark, along with a bevy of friends. Well, there was a furious exchange. This is not the way you're supposed to behave in front of the king. All three of these folks were professing their loyal outrage at the way they'd been treated. Charles finds it very difficult to be regal under this attack. It feels a bit like the sort of back and forth you'd get in a playground, to be honest. He orders them to remove themselves. They refuse and clamour on about each of their various injustices until, in a right paddy cutting through all this, Rupert loudly declares, "By God, the cause of all this is Digby!" Charles, by this stage, has lost all majesty. His reply is hurt, petulant sarcasm. "Pardon me, I am but a child. Digby can lead me where I list." Rupert and co. look nonplussed, and they all go. There is a route back to reconciliation. Rupert insisted on a court-martial, which found him guilty of being a bit indiscreet and a bit wild, but not of being treasonous, a solution which made nobody happy, but was at least bearable to all parties. Rupert and Legg would be reconciled to the king by December. But look, the message of Charles's story in 1645 so far is that it is all falling to pieces. Returning to Fairfax and Cromwell then, they had split up after Bristol, Fairfax to sweep up the southwest, Devon and Cornwall, Cromwell to the south of England to close down the various royalist garrisons there. By and large, both offer lenient terms to fortresses to surrender, and they duly do. Winchester and Langford House, for example, surrendered on generous terms. The exception was Basing House, a loyalty house as it's called. This, the third of their sieges, was defended as stoutly and bravely as the others. This one, though, only lasted 6 days. They refused to surrender, and so the bombardment went ahead, and a breach was duly made. They were again summoned by Cromwell to surrender. The Marquess of Winchester thought about this now. In the vast majority of cases during the Civil War, quarter ended up being given anyway. So, the good Marquess rolled the dice. It was a poor decision. The new model was faced with storming the walls, and afterwards, having been through that pain, they let rip. Many died in the fierce fighting, about 100 defenders, 50 attackers. For a while, no quarter was given, and probably about 100 died until Cromwell relented and gave quarter. The castle was then taken over and given a thorough sacking. Everything portable was removed, and in fact, a local market for grain and bricks was started too. Now, the Marquess was Catholic, so worst of all, 6 priests were found and murdered. The Marquess himself was sent to the Tower on charges of high treason, which were never prosecuted, actually, and he regained his lands at the Restoration and lived to the ripe old age of 72. Is that ripe? Anyway. Cromwell then marched his men back to join Fairfax in the West Country. As was normal, the fortifications at Basing were slighted. It is a common story by all the parliamentary commanders, and the same was done at countless places by countless commanders and by order of Parliament often. Quite often, though, it's one of those, Cromwell and his soldiers, along with iconoclasm, Christmas and all that sort of thing. And again, this is Parliament and, you know, good sense, not Cromwell. Totally sensible. After all, what state would be happy with the idea of a bunch of private fortresses existing up and down the country? In this case, Cromwell told the locals to take what bricks they wanted, and many are therefore to be found in local houses still. Another example of all this is Lady Banks's stout resistance at Corfe Castle in Dorset. Eventually, the siege by Colonel Bingham had its impact. She surrendered and was allowed to march out. In this case, the inhabitants of nearby Poole thought, we'll have a bit of that. They petitioned Parliament for the castle to be demolished and the proceeds used to maintain the poor of the town. And so Parliament decreed that it should be partially so, slighted at least. And very picturesque Corfe Castle looks too. In Devon and Cornwall, the last of the resistance dragged on around Exeter and in Cornwall. And the prize was not just to squash the last of resistance, but to capture Charles, the Prince of Wales, and the commanders and advisers around him. The marginalised Edward Hyde was one of those. The commander with whom we started this war, Ralph Hopton, was another. There they were in Exeter and then in the castle at Pendennis, and as they tried to reconstitute a new army from overtaxed and overweary Cornwall, you can almost hear them scrawling, "They are coming! We cannot get out!" in old dusty diaries. Eventually, Hopton was forced in February 1646 to sally out with his remaining army, 5,000 strong, to challenge Fairfax's relentless advance with his 10,000 men. Hopton took up a defensive position outside Torrington in Devon, and there is a potential for me to go into this in depth because Jane very kindly lent me a book on the battle and a lovely history too. Thanks, Jane. But this is not that time, I think. Essentially, Hopton was overwhelmed and pushed back into the town where there was fierce fighting, and the Royalist powder store blew up and demolished the church in which it was kept, and the prisoners held there went with it. Hopton withdrew to Truro. In March, he then surrendered to Fairfax and was allowed to go free. He, the Prince of Wales, Hyde and a bevy of Royalist advisers fled then to Jersey, where the young 16-year-old prince had a pinnace built for him and had a great time sailing around the island, which does sound fun. Good to get away and hide from all those mouldy, serious-faced advisers like Edward Hyde. Back in Cornwall, Fairfax reached St Michael's Mount and there found a grubby-looking Marquess of Hamilton and released him back into the wild. He went immediately to London, signed the Solemn League and Covenant and swore to retire from any kind of politicking. I mean, who would serve a king who had treated him so rubbishly? Well, James Hamilton would, was the answer, as it happens. He would be encouraged out of retirement by an apologetic king offering gifts, a dukedom and sinecures. at which we should all mutter, Timeo Danaos et dona ferentum, I fear the Greeks when bearing gifts. Because the result in the long run would be the same for Hamilton as it was for the Trojans. But also, his brother Lanark and the Duke of Argyll were at him too, and so in the end, yes, he went back to the king, and we will hear of him again. Poor lamb. So we are close to the end of all the fighting, but that came on the 21st of March. As Charles sat in Oxford contemplating his options, in December 1645, the rather loyal and rather unsung hero Jacob Astley was sent out with a mission to gather up an army from whatever he could find and bring them to Oxford. Now look, this was really tough. After all, Charles no longer had much territory to tax, so money was short. And if you're going to choose a side to fight for at this late stage, surely it would start with a P, not a C. But there was Chester and North Wales and some garrisons in the West Midlands. The back of the sofa, essentially. So out went Astley, up to Chester, which seemed like a good destination, although Chester then finally gave up in February 1646 and came to terms. So on Astley went, raising troops in Wales and bits and bobs from as many of those garrisons as he could. Eventually, he'd managed to gather up all the fluff and old buttons and things. In this case, that meant about 3,000 men, half of whom were figured to be reformados, reformados being captain without men. A pretty ragged bunch then for all, for whom the end of the war would be the end of a career. And as Charles's forlorn hope marched, there was little rejoicing and much plundering. Astley was being shadowed by a Welshman, Thomas Morgan, for Parliament. Morgan had learned English during the 30 Years' War, fighting for the Protestant cause with De Vere, and had a pretty tidy war fighting for Fairfax. With his 3,600 men, he chased Astley down as he headed for Oxford, caught up with him at Stow-on-the-Wold on the 21st of March. By the sound of things, it was a hard-fought battle, but in the end, the reformados broke and ran. The story goes then that Astley was captured in the town and looked pretty knackered, as you would do. He was 67 now and had enjoyed a pretty full military life, including being the military tutor of Prince Rupert, fighting at Edgehill, Gloucester, Newbury, Naseby, and now Stow-on-the-Wold. So, finding him all knackered and all that, Morgan's soldiers found the old chap a drum so that he had something to sit on. Astley sat down, looked at his captors and remarked breezily, "Well, boys, you've done your work. Now you may go and play, if you don't fall out amongst yourselves." That Astley, he knew a thing or two. He then gave his parole to Morgan not to fight again, and unlike plenty others, did not break his word, retired to Maidstone, as people do, and died in 1652. Which brings us to Oxford, really, and back to Charles, sitting there receiving bad news after bad news. Charles's attitude and mood since Naseby had been up and down like a yo-yo. Up for wild optimism, down for despair. Defeat brought not wisdom, nor the spirit of compromise. It brought instead a growing fatalism and redoubling of his determination not to quit his grounds. But there was a growing sense of realisation that while, of course, God would never allow rebels and traitors to prosper and that ultimate victory for the royalist cause was inevitable, the truth was emerging that he might not be God's instrument to achieve it. So after the fall of Bristol, he wrote to his son and heir Charles, ordering him to get ready to go to France and impressing on him that if he was captured, he must on no account yield to any conditions that are dishonourable, unsafe to your person, or derogatory to royal authority. He wrote to Edward Nicholas of his determination never to yield up this church to the government of Papists, Presbyterians, or Independents. Just as the English Presbyterians and Scots were determined to force a new church on England, so Charles was determined to stand by the new church he and his instrument of oppression, Laud, had enforced on the English. Makes you feel someone ought to say, let's forget uniformity. Why doesn't every congregation just choose their own way to God instead? Oh, wait, some people are saying that already. I may be revealing my prejudices and biases here. Charles also wrote to Nicholas with exactly the same message as regards royal power and advised that anybody who told him to recede in the least title, I shall esteem him either a fool or a knave. Thus was Rupert banished for advising him that now he must treat for peace and his personal survival. Of his close counsellors, only Digby, Edward Nicholas and Jack Ashburnham remained reliable in his view at all. Edward Hyde had long been sidelined and sent away with the Prince of Wales. Now the Earls of Dorset, Hertford, Lindsay and Southampton were to go as well. They had begged the King to negotiate for peace. Charles's response to them was that he would place his crown on his head and preserve it with his sword, if the swords of his friends failed him. The four of them effectively had tried to stitch up a deal with Parliament to seize Charles's person and deliver him to London. Sadly for them, the last place on earth Parliament wanted Charles was in London, where he might whip up public support for the crown. In fact, Charles would make the very selfsame offer later and receive a horrified, not on my sainted grandmother's Nelly, in reply from Parliament. Still, the four of them had tried a coup, after all. Right, you need to set up now, listen to this bit, pause your ironing, or take a break from your running and catch your breath, stop the car in a lay-by, pull the emergency cord on the train, or whatever, because what I am about to say, I think, will tell you everything you need to know until January the 30th, 1649. Charles had already alluded to the concept of martyrdom way back in 1642, when he told the long-suffering Hamilton that no extremity or misfortune shall make me yield, for I will either be a glorious king or a patient martyr. In 1645, to his son, he wrote that compromise would make me end my days with torture and disquiet of mind, but your constancy will make me die cheerfully. To Digby, he wrote, if I cannot live like a king, I shall die like a gentleman. Now look, I once went on a training course about negotiating skills. The bloke there told a tale of the negotiations at the end of the Vietnam War, and the message he had was that the Vietnamese had been prepared to sit for years to get what they needed and had no desire to negotiate from what they wanted, and so basically stuffed their opposing negotiators. I have absolutely no idea if this is true or not. He's just a sales trainer. But his point was that it takes two both to tango and to negotiate. And there is no point trying to make a deal with somebody who does not want to negotiate. I would, highly controversially, suggest this may well be what Parliament is going to do now in spades. Negotiate with a man who thought his best interests outweighed those of his subjects. Or maybe that's a bit harsh. Maybe negotiate with a man who believed that his own interests as king were absolutely indistinguishable with the best interests of his subjects and was prepared to be a martyr if he couldn't get it. Okay, Charles then had a few more choices. You can start your car up and start ironing again now. One of his choices, and his favourite, had been the Irish, who we talked about earlier. So let's catch up on how that had gone. You might remember that Charles had sent Glamorgan out with a secret plan to smile and wave at Ormond and in the background to cut his legs off by negotiating a secret deal on his own. And that secret deal had indeed been negotiated by Glamorgan, toleration and land rights for the Catholics in return for 10,000 men for Charles. Then two things happened. Firstly came the arrival of one Cardinal Giovanni Battista Renuccini, a papal nuncio sent by the new Pope Innocent in response to a request sent by the Confederates back in 1643, actually. Now, Renuccini is an interesting and controversial character. The historian Tig O'Henrician summarises the two opposing camps of opinion on Renuccini, both contemporary and modern, as on the one hand, a rash, intransigent and unrealistic zealot, with a more complimentary and view by nationalist historians, which emphasise his devotion to the Catholic cause. Here is Tighe's own assessment. He was highly intelligent, psychologically shrewd, meticulous, persistent, and an inspiring orator in both Italian and Latin. His passionate religious convictions and his belief in an interventionist deity meant that, while often adept at political manipulation, at bottom he was no politician. So, Rinuccini came with a view that was European, the view of the Counter-Reformation than of native Irish Catholicism. He came with a view that toleration was lily-livered and wishy-washy. What was required was the complete re-establishment of an established Catholic Church of Ireland, along with the repatriation of all the stolen good lands. We'll have those back now. He also came with the view that any deal that tried to shore up Charles was just not ambitious enough or indeed realistic enough. What was needed was for the Confederates to completely capture all of Ireland. Then, from a position of strength, they could impose a settlement. He also came with great religious authority and, crucially, some dosh. His arrival gave leadership to the clergy because they had always agreed that complete mastery in Ireland was critical, but now they had a powerful leader and could make their voice dominant. In addition, and just as crucial, was that the very best Irish commander agreed with them wholeheartedly, Owen Roe O'Neill, the Confederate commander in Ulster, facing the new Scots and Robert Munro. Rinuccini did not approve of the Glamorgan Treaty, and he did not trust the Confederate faction of Old English who had pushed it through and were even now raising regiments to provide said army of 10,000 men in England. However, he decided he could not get his alternative entirely through, so instead he worked with what he had. He called Glamorgan in, ripped up the old treaty and proposed another. The return of all those church lands, complete authority of the Catholic Church, etc., and so on and so forth. Now, to make everyone dance to this tune, he also came with news. News that Henrietta Maria's envoy to the papal court, another Digby, this one much more impressive actually, Kenelm Digby, about whom I must write sometime, he had just agreed a deal with the Pope. Which is probably true, though it had absolutely no chance of being approved by anyone, but it did help swing things, and Glamorgan agreed to everything in the secret treaty number 2. All looking good then, and it has to be said that Rinuccini surely had a point. I mean, what was the point of trying to shore up a king who'd clearly lost military in England already, or bar the shouting? So Rinuccini's strategic grasp of that, at least, seems pretty robust. But he was in the balance. Would the rest of the Confederates, and the Old English in particular, could they be brought to agree with this radical new view and strategy? Well, then an event came in as number 2. There was an ambush, the letters of a Catholic archbishop were captured, and in those papers was the original Glamorgan Treaty giving all this stuff away. Well, when that got out, and get out it did, no cat with any number of pigeons could have sent more feathers flying. Parliament and the Protestant English had further evidence of the depth of Charles's duplicity. Here was the thing that he had sworn blind never to do. Ormond suddenly realised that his king valued him not one dot and had been playing him for a patsy and put Glamorgan in charge behind his back. Plus, Ormond was a convinced Protestant and was horrified at the Anglican Church of Ireland being sold down the river. Charles and Digby, meanwhile, panicked. So their solution of how to get out of this mess was to categorically dump Glamorgan in the brown stuff. Absurd, they said. Glamorgan never had the right to negotiate such a settlement. He's absolutely exceeded his bounds. When Glamorgan then produced the papers from the king, giving him complete carte blanche, Charles denounced them as forgeries. Ormond had Glamorgan thrown in the slammer. Now look, this is yet another age-old, much-repeated example of the servant being stitched up to preserve the needs of the master. Charles has done it a few times, but he's surely not alone in history. The immediate impact, though, was to utterly sink this new Glamorgan Treaty and the old one too, and the idea of an Irish army in England was dead. Now, that army that was being gathered was to be diverted to Rinuccini's plan, the conquest of Ireland. And that meant defeating Munro's new Scots in Ulster And that meant invading and capturing Dublin and the Pale. You can hear how that goes in the next episode. So, Charles's options had just shrunk even more, but there was another one. In the form of another international diplomat, Jean de Montereuil. Montereuil was a French diplomat. He had been appointed by the young King Louis XIV's famous first power broker, Cardinal Mazarin. Mazarin authorised Montereuil to try and get Charles and the Scots to come to a deal. He was, and I quote, to lead the Scots to understand that they will have no reason to doubt France will assist them with banners unfurled. Hurrah! Understandably, the Covenanters assumed this to mean military support, banners unfurled and all that sort of thing. Behind his hand, though, in France, Mazarin made it quite clear to Montereuil that he would not commit the life of one Pomeranian grenadier to Scotland's cause. Well, Parisian pikeman might be a better phrase. Don't you just love diplomacy? Sent abroad to lie for your country. Anyway, now, Charles's wife, nor Montereuil, nor anyone, had yet managed to shift Charles towards acceptance of the Presbyterian church model demanded by the Scots. Charles had incidentally also recently sent feelers out to Fairfax for a chat, rejected by him, of course. But Montereuil kept at it, sneaking into Oxford time and again to see the king. It's not entirely clear who exactly said what to whom through Montereuil's brokering. And indeed, it may well be that Montereuil was in fact not being an honest broker, more along the lines of being a more than a little dodgy broker and saying to each person what they wanted to hear in order to get them together. Either way, Charles thought that he had won a commitment to being placed back on the throne by the Scots and a commitment from the Covenanters that he would not be pressed beyond what his religious conscience could bear. The Covenanters would not prove to take that view of what had been agreed, but look, we'll see how that goes. By April 1646, as news came in that Exeter had fallen to Parliament as well, Charles's options were to sit where he was as Fairfax tightened the siege about Oxford and hope for a miracle. Without the miracle, that could really end only one way. Or he could take the initiative and just turn up in London. Since Parliament were clearly worried about the trouble he could cause in London if he was physically there, that would seem like an encouragement to do that very thing. Or he could believe what he wanted to believe and what Montereuil was telling him, that the Scots could now reinstall him on his throne with some vague promise of toleration for Presbyterians, which would not go against his vow to maintain his version of the Church of England. Well, on the 27th of April, two men and their servant, apparently called Harry, left the east gate of Oxford in the middle of the night, headed over Magdalen Bridge, terribly spelled Magdalen Bridge, up Headington Hill out of Oxford. Before long, they'd be on the way towards London, staying the night in Henley-on-Thames and then in Harrow, which is just 15 miles north of Westminster. Now, the end of the First Civil War is normally taken as 24th of June, when Oxford surrenders and Rupert and Morris left England, though it is noted that Wallingford held out to July, and I think Harlech in Wales held out longest until March 1647. But effectively, by the 27th of April 1646, Charles had made his choice. Because, as you will probably have guessed, that servant was no servant called Harry, but was in fact Charles Stuart, the King of England, reliving the days of his youth with the dashing Buckingham, setting out on an adventure in deepest, darkest, cleverest disguise. So that's enough for now. We'll find out where he goes and what then happens in episode 400. However, before then, it is time for another At a Gallop episode, I think. We'll do all of the First Civil War in one galloping episode. So that's what's coming next time. Should be a hoot. Meanwhile then, thanks very much for listening, for all your comments and all that sort of thing. It's always lovely to hear from you. Good luck, everyone, and see you back in the saddle next time.